Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Good evening. Welcome to Interchange here on WFHB. I am your host, Ryan Dawes. Tonight's guest is a nationally acclaimed author with 9 thriller mystery novels under his belt. He is also a former private investigator and newspaper reporter with a degree in criminal justice. Michael Caraita, thank you very much for joining us here on Interchange.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Now, Michael, your 9th book, it's a fantastic thriller called The Prophet. It releases today in bookstores and online across the U.S., We'll get to that in a second, but first, you went to high school and college here in Bloomington. You got a degree in criminal justice from IU. Now, what made you decide to write about bad guys rather than use your degree to try and catch bad guys?
Well, I guess I did a little bit of both for a while. I was a private detective as my day job until writing was, doing well enough to support me full-time. But it was always an intertwined sort of thing. I had an interest in the profession and the field and the realities of it, but my first love has always been writing. It's always been stories. And the stories that I connected with really early were mysteries. And as my personal experience, professional experience evolved, I was given the opportunity to work with a private investigator, to work at the Bloomington Herald-Times and work on some crime stories, do the police beat, run that sort of shift. And those things all just fed together. I've always been drawn toward darker stories and toward suspense. So I think one really fed the other.
Now talk about what it means to become a private investigator. People think of the police doing that type of work for the most part, but there is this whole other branch that's privatized, obviously, private investigator. How do you get into that field? And what was your experience within that field that you drew off of for your thriller novels?
Sure. Well, it's an imperative role, really, because the police are able to step in when charges have been made. But in terms of investigating any sort of personal circumstance, whether it be the potential for criminal activity, we did a lot of cases that ended up being fraud cases. We worked wrongful death. We worked some things that ended up being police investigations down the road, but we were called in early stages. And then in the civil sector, in the private sector, you still have that need for investigation. You still have the need to go into court prepared to argue a compelling case. And that's where street investigation comes in, and it will never be replaced. You need someone out there playing the role of the detective, doing those interviews, digging through records, and really putting together the best case, whether it be a child custody situation, whether it be a business fraud situation, or whether it be a criminal situation that just hasn't reached a level where police are able or willing to take action yet. And, I had an advantage in this town. I've had a lot of advantages in this town. This community has been great to me. The investigator I worked with, Don Johnson, of Trace Investigations, he was incredibly generous to me with his time and his teaching. But he also, because of the size of this community, we were able to see a really wide variety, both criminal and civil. And I think that's something that, had I been in a larger market, had I gone off to, I originally started working with Don as an intern and then progressed to part-time and then full-time work. Had that been in New York or Chicago, my opportunities would have been limited. And I think the scope of the investigations I would have seen much more narrow. But because this community is just the right size, Don didn't need to focus on one particular concentration, and we were able to see cases of a really diverse background. And that, for a writer, is the best thing in the world. You can draw so much upon that.
Now, as a journalist and as a private investigator, you're challenged with using public record as well as knocking on doors and making phone calls. Is that similar with a private investigator, where you're literally knocking on doors and trying to get people to talk to you?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's often more challenging as a private investigator. There are times when, depending on the story, people fear the media, certainly. So, you know, I had that background from my days as a reporter at the HT, and it certainly is true when you're doing PI work, because oftentimes people don't want to be called into court. You know, they don't want that subpoena, they don't want that appearance. Sometimes they have something to hide, other times they just don't trust you. And so in both roles, it's about creating, it's problem solving, it's finding ways around brick walls, which was always a lot of fun for me. Looking back, it seems fun. There were days when it seemed anything but fun. But the other thing that I think was really key is you have to learn how to create a shared language and how to put people at ease. And particularly in reporting, you know, I learned so much working with a reporter here in Bloomington named Laura Lane, who what Laura does, which is just, it's fascinating to watch. And I worked next to her for a number of years. She's a chameleon. You know, she'll interview the mayor, and you'll hear one tone of voice and one, you know, level of conversation, and she's putting, you know, she's creating the right conversation environment for that interview. And then she'd switch gears to another story, and she'd be talking to, you know, someone about an old pickup truck they'd restored. And you'd hear, again, that shift to, you know, what is my common language here? How do I make this person feel most comfortable? And how do I build a rapport? And that is so important, both in both those roles. And then as a novelist, I think it's really, it boils down to the idea of being able to put yourself in someone else's skin, as, you know, that's the To Kill a Mockingbird quote, and walk around in it for a while. I think in every professional role I've played, there's been some level of that.
Now, being a thriller novelist specifically, you must be well acquainted both in your professional research in past jobs as a PI and newspaper reporter, as well as your imagination as a novelist. You must be well acquainted with, you know, death and murder and mayhem. Now, I want to know what it's like to write these types of books. Is it as exciting for you to write as it is for us to read, or is it more meticulous?
Well, I think excitement's part of it in terms of the suspense and trying to draw out that emotional connection. You know, I want to make the heart race a little bit more and certainly build suspense. But one of the things I've always tried to hold as a paramount goal, and it probably does come from having worked in the real world on these sort of issues, is that I'm never comfortable using the idea of violent crime as simply entertainment. And, you know, I would hope you'd see that evolution in my work over the years. I think you certainly, hopefully, would see it in the new book, The Prophet. But one of the great things about my work experience was the chance to really remind myself or see firsthand that this is affecting people on a tragic, traumatic level. And you always want to remember that even though it's fiction, you need to treat, you know, the human condition and the human experience with the utmost respect. And so when, you know, when a body hits the floor in one of my books, I never want to think of that as a convenient plot device. I want to think of that as a person who lived and breathed and was close to others. And I think that's something that the writers I admire have always done.
There's a great passage that you come right out of the gate with in your prologue that I really like about how a cat hunts,
right,
and how it specifically hunts birds near a bird feeder. Will you read that passage for us? Because I think it illustrates exactly what you pointed out, and that it's not just blood and guts and action and adventure. You're trying to expose the psychological aspect of these thrilling, exciting moments that, you know, may be good or bad.
Sure.
In this case, obviously bad.
Sure, yeah, we're in the head of a sociopath here, so it's definitely not good. Let's see where this is and get started. A cardinal was the third creature he ever killed. Caught it beneath his grandmother's bird feeder. He'd watched the cat's approach to this task and marveled. The cat didn't hide. It just waited with incredible, dazzling patience. There was no cover under the bird feeder, nothing to shield a killer, and still the killer succeeded. As the cat approached, the birds would scatter. The cat was unbothered by that, content in his role and devoted to it, possessed of unusual clarity of purpose. The cat would simply settle down into the grass beside a dusting of fallen sunflower seeds and wait. And without fail, the birds would return. Even though they could see the cat, its lack of motion reassured them, convinced them that they were safe. The cat never reacted to those first birds. The cat would wait and watch, and eventually they'd become so confident in their safety that one would come just near enough, and then there would be a blinding strike and those around the victim would scatter. Give them enough time, though, then they would return. Always. Because the feeder was there, the feeder was home, and though they might be capable of remembering what had befallen one of their own in the same spot, they did not believe it could happen to them as well. Unshakable confidence. Unshakable stupidity. He is fascinated by the confident specimens of the helpless. He finds no fascination in the fearful.
Now, this is from the perspective of a sociopathic murder in your novel, but this passage I think says just as much about the victims and those around the victims as it does the murderer.
Sure, sure, and his view of them, at least, certainly.
Now, is this true for all humans, or do you think it's a certain... Because we're talking... I want to talk a little bit about the novel. This novel is set in a very small town in the Rust Belt, Chambers, Ohio, and I think the way in which a small town reacts to big news throughout the book plays a big role, and it plays a role in which people band together, sometimes people fracture, and it is all indicative of what we've all observed in small towns.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think these birds that are being hunted by this cat, is that more indicative of small towns or all humans?
Well, I think the small town role certainly plays a tremendous part in the book. That passage is a limited point of view. It's the way this particular individual regards his victims. And I do think that one of the things we see a lot, particularly if you're involved as a reporter or as an investigator, but really anyone who reads the headlines, is that notion of being lulled into a sense of safety, security. And you see tragedy happen next door and still think, well, it won't happen at my door. And that was one of the ideas I wanted to explore in the book. I also was very interested in the way particularly small towns, when a crime strikes, there's this very disconcerting, disturbing, really, desire that, and I think we've seen this in Bloomington recently, there's a desire to attach personally to that crime. And on one level, that's good. On one level, that's empathy. On another level, it really is a little bit disturbing because people who are so far removed from the individual, the victim, and those involved with the tragedy, because it is a small community, they suddenly want to reach out and touch it and feel as if it brings some sort of excitement almost. And I always, we've watched that play out in this town and certainly in countless other towns around it. And I always find it a really interesting moment of human nature, which is we have sort of a lot of us have sort of a sick desire to float around these bad things, and there's some level of excitement in feeling as if it was close to us. But then if it really is you, there's nothing there except tragedy.
Now, your novel that's coming out today, The Prophet, it's about a small town, as we mentioned, Chambers, Ohio. This town has high unemployment, high crime rates, and the only thing this town seems to have going for it is its high school football team, the Cardinals, led by one of the protagonists in the book, Coach Kent Austin. The other protagonist is Kent's brother, who is a bail bondsman. His name is Adam Austin, and they both start as football players in their own high school careers. Now, you did some extensive research for this book. Adam's character, a bail bondsman, you would obviously have some prior knowledge of that field, given your work covering crime for the Herald Times, as well as...
Yeah, we did some skip tracing and bond tracing when I was doing PI work, too, so...
So you're well acquainted with that, but as far as a football coach, the character in your book, Kent Austin, he's a football coach. The town sort of looks to him in moments of tragedy or in success, which usually happens to be in most cases because of the football team that he leads. Now, you actually shadowed local Bloomington High School North football coach Scott Bless for a year, was it?
Yeah, it would have been a little over a year by the time things were all said and done, because Scott hasn't lost his shadow. I keep showing up. I'm sure he's wondering when he's going to get rid of me. Scott was incredibly helpful, and the whole staff, really. That contact was facilitated. I went to North, but I didn't play football, and Coach Bless wasn't there at the time. The initial contact was facilitated by a friend named Tyler Abel, who was their offensive coordinator. And I wanted to be able to write about the world and the character with authenticity, and I didn't know the world, so I had to be able to step into it as much as possible. And, I can't thank Coach Bless enough for the access he gave me. I spent spent time in their coaches' meetings and at practices. I was on the sidelines during games. They really opened up their program to me, and that was the book would not have been it might have been written, but it wouldn't have been anywhere near as hopefully successful as it is without that sort of access. And it was really fascinating to watch not just everything that goes into creating a winning product on the field, but to watch how Scott and these other coaches balance so many aspects of their lives. I mean, this is a guy who's a dedicated husband and father, and he's just got a lot on his plate, and he manages to balance everything. And I think the idea that the kids came first and wins came second, he's really been able to sell that in the program. So I can't speak highly enough, Scott.
We're speaking with author and novelist Michael Kreida about his new book, The Prophet, which is in stores today. He followed Bloomington High School North football coach Scott Bless. Now talk a little bit about some more of these unspoken responsibilities that you observed that is required of a football coach. I'm sure you learned a lot not having played football in high school yourself.
Yeah, I just had a fan's perspective to the game and understand just how complex it is. And I've never seen a sport that asked more mentally of a group of 15, 16, 17-year-old kids. It's really astonishing how much they have to take in. Now, in terms of watching, Coach Bless and Coach Abel and the rest of the staff, Coach Teakin, who drives in from Brown County where he teaches every day to coach, these are guys who are giving up a tremendous amount of time for, very little money. And it's about a love of the game and a love of helping these kids. But it was really interesting to me to see how they had to manage their day jobs and their home lives and their families, and then care about the wins and losses, and they're determined to get as many wins as possible, but to really be determined about how to best help the kids as well. And one of the things they talk about a lot in that program is that over the years, their kids, football has been better to their kids than their kids have been to football, and that's exactly what they want. They want the game to have a positive impact for athletes who aren't going to go off and play again. And it just takes an incredible amount of energy. I mean, I watch Scott, and it's just, how deep is your well of energy? He's got, a 10-year-old and a 5-year-old, and he's teaching and he's coaching, and it's just, they burn a different level of fuel than I do. He's running on jet fuel.
I think especially for small towns, a coach, especially in a high-profile sport such as football or basketball, they hold a special role in the community. For example, and I'm going to refer to your book, there's a character, as we mentioned, the protagonist, Kent Austin. He's the head football coach, and there is a murder in the town. One of the receiver's girlfriends is murdered, and he is among the first people called in by the police. Now, you don't have to get entirely too specific because it can be, either personal or confidential, but are there certain instances where maybe Coach Bless or other coaches might think to themselves, I'm a football coach, why am I getting roped into these community issues or these personal issues? And, how do you handle that with grace from what you've observed of the coaching staff here in Bloomington?
Sure, yeah, I wouldn't want to attempt to speak for them on that issue, but one of the things that interested me from the start was the way a coach can become an iconic figure in a town and is suddenly expected to play a role that, that goes well beyond the field. And, you know, I think of Tony Dungy, what he came to represent in Indianapolis, and I spend part of the year in St. Petersburg, and his other hometown, his home now is Tampa. And Coach Dungy was a very prominent community figure in both
the
places.
Former coach of the Colts.
Exactly, former coach of the Colts, Super Bowl coach for the Colts. And, you know, he was very involved with prison ministry, which is one of the things that Ken Austin is involved with in the book. And I was interested in coaches to really step forward and try and embrace a role that they probably don't necessarily always enjoy and aspire to, which is, you know, to be a voice and a representative and ambassador of the community. And we've seen some coaches who have done that very well, and we've seen some coaches who, you know, are anything but good ambassadors for the community. And it's just, you know, that's a burden you step into with that role that I think is probably unanticipated. And I think a lot of these guys don't hunger for that at all, and the ones who do hunger for it, you should probably be a little leery of.
I see. Now, do you yourself follow sports?
Oh, absolutely. Huge sports fan. I played a little bit of basketball. I played a very bad game of basketball. Played baseball as a kid, and I've been a huge sports fan since I was really young. I had the misfortune of having a family from Cleveland, so I was, you know, an Indians fan and a Browns fan, and so I grew up with a really good understanding of how sports represents tragedy, because it does every season in Cleveland. So, you know, there's...
But you also learn loyalty being a sports
exactly,
fan in Cleveland.
Exactly. So there's no question that the price of being a Cleveland fan informed this book. Huge Colts fan. You know, I take a road trip with a couple friends every year to catch the Colts on the road. Tyler Abel would be one of those guys. And it's just, I think what really fascinated me and brought me toward this material in the book is the way a community can rally behind a team. And, Cleveland's a good example. Green Bay is a good example. Pittsburgh. These towns that fall on hard times, Detroit. You can go on and on and on in this economy right now. And there's something about the rallying around behind a community representative that I think is really just fascinating. And, you go out on an emotional high after a win, and emotionally it can be crushing after a tough loss. And I've always been really interested in how we attach emotionally, you know, to this group that we don't have any personal connection with. And I think it's very similar to books and film and music. Why do you make those emotional connections? And I think it's wrapped up in narrative. Every football game has its narrative. You know, there are the peaks and valleys, there are the, you know, rival stories, the surprise rallies, all of those things are dramatic in nature. It's all story, you know, and I was really interested to think about that as I worked on the book.
You talk in the book about how the coach is concerned after one of the community members, one of the high schoolers, is murdered. The players he predicts will dedicate plays, dedicate games to this person, and he did not want that to happen. Why in this man's mind, why did he not want that narrative, as you say, to play out in these players' mind? Why didn't he want them to connect their plays, their success on the field, to this teenager who had died in real life?
Sure, I think he's very concerned about the scope of what the game really means. And while he believes in the idea that, you know, what he's doing can help these kids off the field, and you've got to remember that he was touched by tragedy at a young age himself, but I wanted him to be very aware of the idea that what is happening in this community that's important should overshadow everything on the football field, and there's going to be an attempt to allow the football to represent this, and that made him profoundly uncomfortable. And I realize as I say this, I'm talking about it as if it actually happened, but as a writer, that's often how you feel. These are not necessarily planned beats. You know, you try and get in the head of the character, and sometimes their responses aren't exactly what you had planned, and that's when writing's really fun. It's when it feels less engineered and more as a journey of discovery, where the characters are having thoughts you didn't anticipate, and they're making moves you didn't anticipate. You know, that's when I love it at that point.
Now, you're talking about narrative earlier and why we are drawn to teams with a narrative, especially local teams, when a certain town is falling on hard times.
Sure.
And I'm wondering why do you think we do that? And do you think it's good because the character you designed in this book did not want that to happen in this specific instance, but when you reference towns throughout the Rust Belt who, you know, have hard economic times, you know, why do they find a certain particular attachment to a team when they do well, and a certain they identify more with that team because of the narrative?
Sure. Well, I think it's a provincial idea that's probably uniquely American in some ways, in that you know, they want to have a voice. Each community wants to have its trophy on the wall, you know, whatever that might be. You know, there are community rivalries that are healthy and unhealthy, but you know, you want to find your community's source of pride in something. And for a lot of these towns, you know, particularly the area I was writing about, that you know, the steel towns that have fallen upon really hard economic times, it's like, okay, well, once, you know, we took great pride in the fact that we manufactured more steel than, you know, 48 other states right here in this county. You know, you see things like that, and now the steel is gone. And so you still want to find that community point of pride, the thing that brings you together. And, you know, that's what I wanted to write about, and I'm hardly, you know, breaking new ground here. I mean, Angelo Pizzo here in town did it so well with Hoosiers. You know, he captured that sort of mania and madness, and I think he did a good job of capturing the fact that it's a double-edged sword. We see it with Friday Night Lights, which was the book was a very, you know, dark portrait of, of what can happen, you know, when football overshadows a town. But it's certainly prevalent in America, and I think anytime, you know, there's something like that going on, it just sparks some of the writing instincts. You want to try and capture that.
We're speaking with novelist Michael Kreida about his new book, The Prophet, currently in stores across the U.S. Stay tuned to Interchange. We'll be right back after a short break.
Thank you.
And we're back. We're speaking with nationally acclaimed author and Bloomington resident Michael Kurita, whose ninth thriller novel comes out in bookstores today across the U.S. as well as online. Your latest book, The Prophet, is about a high school coach and his brother who is a bail bondsman, and they're both caught up in a, not as perpetrators, but certainly heavily involved in solving a murder in their small town of Chambers, Ohio. Now, the brothers themselves diverged in a key moment in the book, you know, in their teenage years. They don't talk to each other anymore, and they diverged after the death of their own middle sister. She was abducted and murdered when Kent was a freshman in high school and Adam was a senior. They were both on the high school football team in the book. At which point in the book, when their middle sister was murdered, Kent turned to football entirely. He turned to God, prayer. He turned to building community. Meanwhile, Adam, the older brother, became an alcoholic. He kind of immersed himself in the underbelly of society, tracking people down who had skipped out on their bail. Now, these two characters responded to a tragedy in their life in very, very different ways, and they both had different roles in their sister's life. Now, what, in your opinion, makes a difference when people respond to a tragedy, like such as the death of a loved one, as what takes place in the book?
Sure. I mean, it's so, I think that would be so colored by the experiences and the environment you come from, and then the support around you. And certainly, you know, people go down different roads in coping with grief. This idea actually had its root in a family story for me. My aunt, my mother's sister, was hit and killed by a drunk driver in Cleveland when she was walking home from school. She was in kindergarten. And my mother did not see it. I had an uncle who saw it happen. And obviously that's just an unbearable trauma for you know, a family to deal with. And my grandmother at the time had, I believe, a one-month-old baby as well. And my grandfather was a minister, as Kent plays that role as well in the book. And, you know, part of that role is to console the grieving, you know, of your congregation. Mm-hmm. And so it was a role he had played for other people. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's the tragedy is at his own door. And it was something that, you know, we didn't talk about a lot when I was a kid, but it certainly was a story that stuck out. I remember once, I don't even know if my mother remembers this, but I remember once trying to, we'd been in an argument of some sort before school, and, you know, I was just being pain in the neck, being a brat, being a kid, and I tried to, you know, storm out of the house in my righteous fury about whatever dumb thing we'd been arguing about, and, you know, she told me that we could never leave in the middle of an argument or on bad terms like that. I don't know if she remembers this, as I said, but it's the one time she referred directly back to, you know, to that incident, to that idea of you never know if someone's going to make it back home. And, you know, that definitely stuck with me, and I've been thinking about that story for a long time, and it finally manifested in this book. And I was curious, you know, what the different responses would be from people of different worlds. There were some differences between my mother's father and upbringing and family and my father's father and that situation. And I remember being pretty young and just, you know, sort of tossing around the idea of, well, what if that had happened on the other side of my family? What if that had happened with my aunt, you know, my dad's sister? And
right.
In a way, I mean, this is going well back. But in a way, I think that got the wheels turning to create these polar opposite responses from Kent and from Adam.
I see. Now, you have a passage that talks about a kind of marginalized way in which Adam, the older brother, the one who's the bail bondsman, who is kind of a community recluse, you have a passage in your book I'd like for you to read for our listeners. And it talks about how one of the ways in which he has responded to the death of his sister. Would you read that for us, please?
Sure. you know, Kent has turned, as you said, he's turned to the church, and has turned to his faith to try and help cope. And then, Adam on the surface would not, but in a way he builds a church of his own. So let's read a short passage here. In the first 2 years after his daughter's death, Hank Austin had put on 45 pounds. After dinner beers became after dinner 12 packs. Morning coffees became morning Bloody Marys. A half pack of cigarettes a day became 2 packs. A slice of pizza became 6, and on. Excess defined him. When the heart attack took him, it was an August afternoon with a heat index of 105, and he decided to sand the deck by hand. When Adam found him, he felt relief amidst the sorrow and the shame. His father hadn't been able to bear the loss, but he'd been a touch too strong to run from it, too. Adam was 22 then, working as a bail agent in Cleveland. The one semester at Ohio State was a distant memory. Kent was a sophomore in college, a starting quarterback for a small program. Adam was still living at home, if living was the right word. It was where he slept from time to time, usually during the day when his parents were gone. He did most of his hunting at night. His boss loved that, and it suited Adam. He was a nocturnal sort. After his father died, his mother moved into an apartment. "You're not happy here," Adam had told her. "There's too much pain all around you. You know that." She'd agreed. Moved into an apartment near the bank where she worked, and Adam stayed in the house. She was there for 9 years, and then the first stroke came, and a month later the second, and her final 4 years were in an assisted living facility. The house was left to Adam and Kent jointly, and Adam had 3 separate appraisals conducted, and then offered his brother half the average, a fair share. Kent refused. Told him they needed to sell the place not for money, but for the purposes of moving on. Adam declined, and each month he sent his brother a check for what he deemed half of the fair rent on the home. Each month, the check went uncashed. Once his father was dead and his mother had moved, Adam finally got Marie's room back the way he wanted it. Hank Austin had been firm. The day Marie's body was found, turning the inevitable into the official, he'd begun to pack her things away, working alone, no sounds but the shrieks and tears of packing tape, and the occasional soft sob. Adam understood both the idea and its futility. It was tempting to try, maybe, but it was hopeless. You couldn't put her into boxes and seal them shut. The boxes had gone into the attic above the garage, and sometimes Adam would slip up there and go through the artifacts, taking in the smell of her, amazed by how it lingered. He was alone with her then, felt close to her in a way he could not anywhere else, and he was certain she was there with him, somehow aware of the communion and appreciative of it. They talked a little. He couldn't get through much at first. The tears came too fast, but over time it got better. He apologized often, too often for her. He knew that, but how did you stop? And he told her what news there was to share. He told her about every skip he tracked down, everyone who jumped bond and tried to hide. He got them all. He was remarkably diligent. His boss in Cleveland was already talking about turning the business over to him, but Adam wanted to come home. He wanted to be in Chambers County. He and Marie talked about that, too. Whether maybe what he needed was exactly the opposite, what he needed was to get out. In the end, though, that just didn't feel right. The dead Adam Ode had been left here on Beach Street in Chambers, Ohio. There were advantages to leaving town. The stares wouldn't follow him in other places. The whispers would never be heard. No one would remember because no one would know. Sometimes that seemed so beautiful, so desirable, that it could nearly bring him to his knees. But he would not run, and that was all it amounted to. Those stares, those whispers, those memories, Adam had earned them. They were necessary reminders, needles of agony that refreshed the heart and kept him focused. He was here to offer atonement. That was not a painless task, and it was not one from which you could run. He made some promises up there in the attic, surrounded by the boxes that testified to a vanished life, and he intended to keep them. When the house was his, no one left to object to a little rearranging, Adam moved Marie back in. It was a painstaking process. The large objects were no problem, he remembered where they belonged, but on smaller issues, the order of books on shelves, the arrangements of posters on the walls, he had to stop and think, and sometimes simply ask for her approval, apologize, and put the things where they seemed to fit. He had not paid enough attention to the details when he'd had the chance, but he was certain that Marie understood and forgave. When he was done, when he'd hung her sign on the door at the last step, he felt cleaner than he had in years. She would not be boxed away. She would not be forgotten. Kent had problems with that. That had been one of their true blow-ups, second to last of the effective end of their relationship. He came in and saw the room and said it was a sick thing to do, that Adam needed help, needed to learn how to move on, that there was no honor for Marie in what he'd done. They disagreed strongly on that point. Then came Kent's visit to Gideon Pierce, her killer. Adam found out about that in the papers. He'd gone to Kent's house, and he would always regret that. He shouldn't have allowed it to happen with Beth present. That argument ended with blood. Since then, the two brothers circled each other with carefully preserved distance.
So, Adam clearly goes too far in preserving his dead sister's memory,
According to Kent.
According to Kent. Now, many people visit a cemetery and they speak to loved ones who have passed away, and many people preserve or will keep items from loved ones, not because they need them or because they're practical, but because it's sentimental. Yet, Adam in this case goes as far as unpacking all of her belongings and attempts to curate her room as the way it was when she was a teenager when she died.
Right.
And he visits this room as an adult and he keeps it intact as Marie, his dead sister, would have wanted. Where does he go too far? And do you think he does go too far?
Well, that's a question I want the reader to answer. That's not something that I really even write with that in mind. I want to look at the different ways people handle their grief. And I think that it's in that friction. It's in that idea of what is the right way that, a lot of the dramatic conflict of the book comes about. And I never write with the idea of here's the point I want to make about the right way to do things. I'm not that smart of a person. And I think there's a certain level of hubris in attempting to write that way. Because we can't, we all love to offer advice. A lot of us do, but it's very tough to know the right way to deal with something that you haven't dealt with. And so I'd like to lay out the different human reactions and to try and feel what they would be and how they would be defended and why they'd be reasonable to at least that character. And in that, I'm trying to give as honest a scope of human behavior as I can. And I think that's when the emotional connection with the reader is really created. And that's, at the end of the day, that's all I'm striving for when I write. I want the reader to feel the book. I want them to connect on a truly personal and emotional level with the characters.
So since you don't try to teach a lesson, you're not instructing the reader how to feel or how to view a situation, it seems as though you're more so bringing up questions and bringing up situations in which you challenge the reader to say, what would you do? I, the author, or I, the protagonist, don't know, but you say, what would you do in these? Do you think this will change because you're about to publish, or you have published your ninth novel, yet
right.
You are 29 years old, which I think most people would say that's pretty young to have that many novels, especially about such meaty subjects. Do you feel like you will maintain this humble approach, or do you think that you might, with more life experiences to draw from, do you think you might change the way in which you strategize in the way you craft the themes and things that you want people to draw from your writing?
Oh, I certainly hope not. I think the sort of writing that I want to do is writing that's deeply felt by the reader. And I think there's, I don't have all the answers, and I would never want to pretend that I did. And I think one of the great challenges we all have, particularly, as you say, when we get older and add life experience, is in the closing of doors, in a closed mind. And, whether that's, from a political or religious ideology to simply believing that you know the best ways for other people to live their life, even a total confidence that you know the best way to live your own life. I think the absolute best approach that I've seen in the people who I really respect and admire are people who are always learning, you know, and have never stopped. I mean, I think of Bob Hamill, my journalism mentor, and this is a guy who's never stopped studying the craft of writing, but also he brings a level of depth of thought to everything from, you know, politics to sports to, you know, whatever the issues of the day are. And my father, the same way. And I think that's, you know, that's what I would strive to do, is always trying, you know, keep those questions open and keep that. I'll go back to Kill a Mockingbird again, but that's the, you know, the Atticus Finch advice is, you know, to try and get inside someone else's skin and walk around in it for a while. And I think we don't see enough of that, probably, in society in a lot of circumstances, and I know I'm guilty of it, so I always try and fight against that.
We're speaking with Michael Carita here on Interchange on WFHB about his new book, The Prophet, which is in stores today across the U.S. Now, from your novel, The Prophet, I've been reading, you can tell that you are a journalist, and it isn't preachy. It's very much more descriptive than I would say most newspaper writing is, but you treat all types of different people very equally, I would say, and there you cover the whole gamut of society in this book, yet you're never right cynically of them or the way that they would respond to a certain situation, unless you're writing in, say, a certain particular voice, such as that of a serial killer. But when it is the narrator's voice, it does seem very fair, and in that way, I think it, like you said, it allows the reader to draw their own conclusions. I think a lot of writers, or any artist for that matter, really want to impose, and maybe impose is a negative word because I don't always think it's a negative thing, but a lot of artists do want their beliefs, their priorities to shine through, whereas in your writing, I can't tell, you know, who you might be in favor of, who you think responds in the best sort of way.
That's great. That's exactly, I appreciate hearing that, because that is the goal. And I think, you know, interpretation should always be left to the audience. And, you know, I wouldn't argue anyone's interpretation. It lands with them the way it lands with them. You know, I'm incredibly influenced by music. I write with music on every day. And I think, you know, a lot of the songwriters I really admire, you know, from a Josh Ritter or a Matthew Ryan, Brian Fallon, you know, down to a Springsteen and Dylan, it's, you know, they're always telling stories that we can all relate to. And I think that they've had a really good grasp of the fact that someone is hearing, they're taking these lyrics and they're holding it up as a mirror and looking at their own lives. They're not looking at my life. When, you know, when I hear a Bruce Springsteen song, I'm not thinking about Bruce Springsteen's life. You know, you're holding it up and looking at your own experiences. And that's why we connect so deeply to certain songs. You know, a song that you hear at the right moment, you know, with the right girl after the right breakup, or, you know, whatever it might be, right. You'll hold on to a certain meaning of that song because of the way it hit you and when it hit you. And I think that's one of the great things about art. It's, you know, it's a chance to take something from someone else's mind, someone else's creation, and bring it into your own life and make it personal. And, you know, I'd love that. I wish I was able to sing, you know, do songwriting. I think that's, you know, one of the best artist-audience connections that exists.
It's interesting how that context can really shape the way in which you perceive an art form, which was, you know, obviously created completely separate, completely ignorant of whatever context in which you're consuming it. One of my favorite experiences I've ever had reading a book was, I was reading The Road by Cormac McCarthy.
Sure.
And at that time, and this was not intentional, but it ended up being a very harmonious timing. I was driving across the Southwest camping, and in The Road, the two characters, they live, it's after the apocalypse,
right.
After the
yeah.
fall of society, people are resorting to cannibalism and, you know, enslaving people, and meanwhile there's a father and son in the book, and they're
sure.
represent one of the last shreds of goodness,
right.
And they're always foraging for food. And they, when anytime they run across a stash of canned goods, it's, you know, it's like gold
it's
to them.
For celebration, yeah.
Yeah, and I was at this time camping in National Forest all throughout the Southwest. Spent about 6 weeks doing it, and right before that trip, my parents very generously took me to Walmart, and we bought about, I don't know, 70 pounds worth of canned food.
Right.
And in other contexts, I would be like, oh, I don't really want canned beans for dinner, but...
Entirely,
you know,
different perspective after
right,
connecting
when I was reading
story,
that book,
yeah.
that those canned beans were so good at the end of each day, hiking or driving, whatever.
Right.
Now, have you had a similar experience where, whether it's a song, a painting, a book, or even for maybe writing or creating something while you're writing a novel, have you ever had an experience where what you were doing was so harmonious with what you were either creating or consuming?
Oh yeah, that's, you know, that's a constant part of what goes into a book. You know, from other things I'm reading to music is such a huge part of my writing, and I create essentially a soundtrack for each novel, and you know, it's always songs that to me lyrically I can feel as if they wrote it just for this book. You know, it's I make a connection to the characters, and I'm like, wow, you know, this guy really just came in there. Brian Fallon put out an album with it was his side project. They were called The Horrible Crows, and I was listening to that while I was writing The Prophet, and I thought, did you write this album just to help me get through this book? Because everything, you know, connected so much. There's a band called We Are Augustines, and there's a song called Juarez, and the lyrics in that, it's tell my sister I've gone and to find someone and I won't come back no more, which is essentially Adam's story. And then there's another line in there.
Right, because Adam takes it upon himself in the book to find the killer of this
young
woman.
At any cost, at any expense, right? And then there's another line where he talks about, there's a line, got a drunk for a mother, got a saint for a brother. And that seemed as if, you know, it was coming out of Adam's mouth to me. Now, what is in the head of the songwriter at the time is something incredibly different, but I'm able to grab that context. And again, that's the incredible privilege and fun of art is knowing that somebody else is grabbing that story, you know, that song, whatever it may be, and taking a personal meaning out of it. You know, that's a really special thing to me.
Now, you tackle in The Prophet, but then in your other books, you tackle a lot of deep and dark issues, you know, murder and death and deceit. But then also you study in the book through these characters, the way in which people react to it. So what are some settings or circumstances or contexts that you imagine a very ideal experience for The Prophet to be read within? Like you mentioned these songs that I can't believe that song was written and I'm now hearing it because it's perfect for what you're doing.
Right.
What experience or environment would The Prophet be most illuminating or effective in for a reader, do you think?
You know, I'd love to see somebody reading it out in the bleachers somewhere, you know, before a game or during a practice or something like that.
Sure.
And the season was so important to me. You know, I guess it... You know, if I could put this book in the hands of someone in the perfect place, you know, it would be empty bleachers with, you know, nice red leaves falling down.
Right, because it takes place during football season
mm-hmm.
in the fall.
Right.
I see. Now, talk a little bit about what are some common threads that you see in your other novels. You have 8 before The Prophet. What are some common threads that you like to explore, and what's some unblazed trails that you want to explore in the future?
Oh, there are a lot of those. You know, I've done some genre hopping. I will again. And I think that's, you know, to keep it fresh creatively, you know, I'd always want to keep doing that. There's certainly a lot of repeated themes in my work. And I think you can see that in most writers where, you know, even if the subject matter and the delivery and execution range around a lot, you see some heartfelt themes. And, you know, I'm very interested in, I think clearly in some sort of gothic ideas of the sense of the past. You know, that idea that the past is never the past. And how it weighs on everything we do. Certainly very interested in the ideas of revenge versus coming to peace with something, revenge versus forgiveness, stories of atonement, stories of self-sacrifice. Those are things that continue to shape the work, and I assume always will, because I think there are core passions, and you've got to write to those sort of stories that make the heart speed up a little more, the stories that you can invest in emotionally. If it's just about plot, then you're done. It's got to be heartfelt.
Well, Michael, that is all the time we have here on Interchange. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, this is my pleasure. Absolutely fantastic interview, and really enjoyed the topics we were able to hit on, so thank you.
Sure. Michael Kreta's new book, The Prophet, in stores across the U.S. You can catch Michael in person at a book signing tomorrow here in Bloomington at the Barnes & Noble on the east side. Again, that's 7 p.m. tomorrow at Barnes & Noble. You can find his book, The Prophet, at all Barnes & Nobles, as well as on Amazon. Interchange is produced at WFHB Studios by myself, Lewis Malone, and Shane Young. Our executive producer is Allison Bechtesh. For WFHB News and Interchange, I'm Ryan Daw. See you next week here on Interchange.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.